Hello and welcome to another episode of the Untalented Podcast. I am joined by the lovely Zara today. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, all good. I'm excited. We will get straight into it with this or that, just to ease us in, get us chatting, which is always fun. Are you ready?
Go.
Chocolate or crisps?
Oh, it depends where I'm at on my cycle. Right now, chocky.
Yeah. Chocky is the saviour forever.
But, you know, a good crisp with a glass of wine, defo, also good.
Yeah, that is so true, actually. Leading or doing?
Both. It depends for me where the project's at, the capability of the team, where their headspace is at, what the client's like. But instinctively, I think doing.
Nice. Yes. Progressive or innovative?
Ooh, for me, progressive, because innovation will serve progress.
Nice, that was good. Photos or videos?
Photos, the craft, the moment in time, the capture is just love. Videos, great, you know, obviously digital age, super important, but photography is kind of, it captures my soul.
Nice. Intuition or insights?
Intuition.
Films or books?
Film. Yeah. I think I'm too lazy to read. I get bored. I forget what I've read in the sentence before.
Really? See, I have that with films. I like sit for an hour and then I'm completely like, what's going on? Clocked out, no attention span, which is so bad. So I think I have to have the book because you have to concentrate continuously, right?
Yeah, I really admire people that are able to sit with a good book. I think that's so cool.
Yeah, but then I also have the other side of it that everyone's like, you haven't seen this film? You haven't watched this one?
Yeah, but
like,
the book's always better, isn't it?
Yeah,
it always is.
True. Winter or summer?
Definitely summer. I fucking hate winter. I turn into an absolute misery. I'll overdo the colour.
Just to brighten yourself up, feel better.
Yeah, if I could live from summer to summer, I would be a very happy woman.
I found myself Googling the SAD lamps, you know, the SAD lamps the other day, and was like, I need one of these, and also ordered a 15 tog duvet and still felt cold. I'm I'm just not built for this. I'm not meant to be... Like, I'm meant to hibernate like a bear, I think, and snooze.
Our bone marrow gets cold in winter.
It's horrible.
What's to like about that?
It's horrible. Cats or dogs?
Definitely dogs. Cats are selfish. Dogs are giving and loving. I need more of that in my life.
Yeah, agreed. Ambition or comfort?
Ambition, big time. I think being comfortable is good. Maybe it depends where you're at in your career as well. Safety. Comfort, super important, but where I'm at right now, progress, ambition. Yeah.
Nice. Skill or fame?
Skill. Fuck fame. Who gives a shit? I mean, look at the celebrities. They're all fucked up anyway, aren't they?
Yeah.
So, no, thank you.
Well, I think like when you're younger, you kind of think, oh, I'd love to be famous because you obviously are like fed it on socials or whatever.
Yeah.
And then you, I don't know, there's like a pivotal point in your life that I think you just think, fuck that.
Yeah.
Can't think of anything worse.
I think it comes with too much complexity and pressure and, you know, also it's like you become famous, then what?
Yeah, that's so true. And there's like the pressure of maintaining, like being better.
Yeah.
Even though you're like, I've kind of peaked. I'm here and I'm famous. What else am I meant to do from here?
Right. Whereas skill, it's just forever evolving and there's always something new and something to strive for. So.
Yeah. And I think someone said on here as well, like the fame can come with skill and you'd rather be famous for being skillful than being famous for being famous.
That's so much more of a smart answer than I came up with.
No, I like
yours. I agree wholeheartedly.
Agree. Well, thank you for joining me. I am going to chuck you straight into the first question of the pod that we make everyone answer. So who was the first person to make you feel talented?
Yeah. I'm going to go with my mum.
Okay, nice.
So my parents have this like really cool combo of my dad was a sportsman. He's very old now, but he taught us kind of commitment and dedication and goal setting and ambition. But my mum brought that sort of creative side mm-hmm. to me and to our family. And I remember when I was really small, I always sort of liked to put on a show.
Okay.
And I would practice all Saturday, maybe have a friend over, and we would practice a dance or a poem or some kind of stupid performance. Okay. And it would always sort of start with me like projecting myself out from behind the curtains onto my stage, which obviously. Was the living room, obviously. And mum was always there, front row, aka sofa. And she just kind of really instilled in me this belief that I was the best dancer or the best singer or the best mm-hmm. poet in the whole of New Zealand, even though I clearly was not. I was absolute shy. But yeah, she just bred that confidence.
Yeah, it's so nice. It's like, it's just that unwavered support, isn't it? Even though your mum is probably sat there thinking, again, another show. But it's like it's the sort of positive reinforcement every time. And also, what is it about like that jumping out of your curtain? Like when I was a kid, we had a big bay window, so it was an actual stage because it was like a big windowsill seat.
Yeah.
And you would draw the curtains and you would be on the stage behind, and it was like the most thrilling experience every time to be like, oh my god, this is the stage. And me and my brother used to do exactly the same thing, just ridiculous crap. And yeah, you look back and you think, oh my god, my poor parents having to withstand me doing that repeatedly.
I know, like, so you know, it's their Saturday too, isn't it? And they mm-hmm. have to sort of go through that torture. I think they kind of love it though. Like, you know, kids on the stage is so hilarious because they're just themselves.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny, but you know, definitely my mum. Although I'm thankful for my dad too, but yeah. Jill Ineson really kind of bred that self-belief that we could do anything, and we were creative.
Yeah, for
whatever
sure.
Whatever that means.
I think it's so good to, like you said, have that balance as well of someone instilling the creativity in you, but then also someone on the complete flip side of that, of almost been like, you are creative, but also these things will help you, like, maybe like be successful in that, and all of like the more harder skills too, which is so good to have that balance. So how did you first like get into this industry? Tell us about that. Tell us about your entrance in and the sort of journey from there.
Creative was plan B, actually. Okay. For me, plan A, so I thought I wanted to be a brain surgeon. And so, I know, right? Nuts. Although kudos to the whole NHS and all the brain surgeons out there. But I came out of school equal parts academic and creative,
mm-hmm.
and went down the medicine route at uni. But you know, I suppose like most students, I spent more time at the pub than I did learning. And so flunked it. Like,
really?
Did a few years of med, but just eventually I wasn't with my people. I didn't feel it. And so I just misbehaved.
Yeah. It's also such an intense thing to study if you're not like fully in it as well. I've never studied medicine, but I assume that you can't just breeze through that. You know what I mean? Like, you need to be in it fully.
Yeah, with anything though, right?
Yeah, true.
You need to feel it and feel the spirit of it and be with your kind of people or your gang, whatever that looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And I just sort of, I wasn't happy, and I instinctively knew that that wasn't right for me.
Yeah.
So bailed and felt a little bit lost. Didn't know what to do. Family friend thought, oh, you know, give a visual communications degree a go. Because I did sort of have that creative spirit in me mm-hmm. along the way. And yeah, so did that. Was really, really lucky, right place, right time, maybe, to get a really good little first sort of entry job in my last year at uni. And my degree let me finish sort of that last year in work, which was just so lucky, and I'm so thankful for that. And yeah, it sort of went from there. I started out as a graphic designer. That first job was actually a cracker in hindsight. It was rebranding and sort of resurrecting a very iconic but sort of dying New Zealand outdoor brand.
Oh, nice.
Yeah,
okay.
Called Fairy Down. And so we did that, and then, you know, spent a few years there, then did another graphic design role in-house, and then made the move to London and started at Porter's, which really, I think, really was sort of the the start of where I am now.
Yeah. So did you was still in a more design-based role when you joined Porter's, right?
It's sort of it's quite unique in fashion in that design and art directing and in a way writing sort of all go hand in hand. I think creatives that come through the fashion industry usually quite well-rounded rather than being super specialist. And so, yeah, like design was sort of my core skill, but when you're in fashion, you need to be an art director, you need to know how to run a shoot. So that kind of evolved with Porter's and working my way through there. And, you know, I just sort of naturally, I'm not a trained writer by any means, but I knew what I wanted my work to say, and so I just sort of started writing as well.
Yeah,
so it all just sort of came together, but not by plan, just sort of fell into it that way.
Yeah, I think it's such an interesting dynamic when you're almost like visual and aesthetic first, and like you said, it's, well, I know what I want the work to say, I just need to be able to like translate that into the word side. I think actually being able to pick up the craft of writing that way is super interesting, rather than the sort of old school Adland-esque way of, well, you do ideas and headlines and scripts and that sort of thing. Like, I think it just is quite, it's obviously so much different, but you're actually fully translating your vision. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean. I mean, God, there's definitely something to be said for writers who just know their craft, and fuck, they could elevate something far more than I ever could. But I think just being able to have a crack even at expressing through words and through visuals what you want to say, and then maybe pulling people around you that can help you elevate that or hone or craft it, is definitely the way. I really don't believe in not giving something a go and that sort of mindset that's like, oh, I'm an art director, so I won't write that manifesto, or I'm not going to have a crack at a headline. Just, if nothing else, write how you would say it, and then, you know, pull your gang around you that might be able to help elevate it for you.
Yeah, I think fashion is such a good entry into doing that as well. I think advertising, like on a whole, is very much craft led. You are this or you are that. I think it is kind of changing now and in more recent years, but I work with quite a few different creatives that have started in fashion, or that's been their main route in, and it's so interesting to see that they are true hybrid thinkers in the way that they approach things. And I've seen a massive increase in agencies wanting that and been like, oh wait, we actually need people from that sort of walk of life who can come in and just have a different perspective and a different technique to doing type of thing.
Yeah, and you know, maybe that is a symptom of the type of there's a real shift in the type of work that the industry is making, and you know, craft is very, very important for some channels, but for a lot of emerging channels, it's kind of spirit maybe is more important, and the core message. And so, you know, maybe for some of the way that brands communicate, the real depth of knowledge of craft isn't as needed. I mean, you've got to start looking at the universities and the schools and kind of questioning that traditional art copy thing. Is that really the future, or should we be breeding and teaching younger people to be a bit more rounded?
Yeah, that's so true. Because the industry is changing quite rapidly, whereas the training methods aren't yet.
100%.
Which is, I've never actually thought about that. And I think there's now so much more scope for creatives to enter the industry without being from ad school. And actually there's more of a demand for that. So yeah, it makes you kind of think, is that route in going to be a dying art? Are people just going to think, why would I do that when I could go and do something else and learn my own craft and then be able to step into that role?
Yep, 100%. Yeah, it'll be really interesting to see how those sort of unis and schools, start to respond and reshape themselves to, set creatives up for the future.
Mm-hmm. So you were at Porter's for quite a long time. Tell us about that. I think it's one of those agencies that people never really know much about. Do you know what I mean? Everyone's like, I want to know what goes on in there and what it is about and what it's like. But I think if you know, type of place, if that makes sense.
Yeah, right. Porter's was wild.
How long were you there? Sorry.
10 years.
Yes, okay.
So, that's my family.
Mm-hmm.
I would consider some of the woman that led that agency, especially Mary and her CEO, Corinne, they were kind of like my moms when I first, in a good way, not a naggy mum way, and we're going to look after you, you're okay and you're safe. I got to London straight out of New Zealand, and it was such a culture shock. And so to have that support and girl gang around me was, in hindsight, really special. But it's a wild place. It's very spirited. It takes on the feeling that you would think Mary's agency would have, which is quite progressive in thought.
Mm-hmm.
A whole lot of fun, a bit naughty, shitloads of swearing, lots of nurture and care and kindness, very deep thinking. It's a real thinking agency. It was a brilliant place to be.
Mm-hmm.
At times, it's a small business, and I think what can come with small businesses is you need to wear a lot of hats.
Mm-hmm.
And Porter's were really generous to me in giving me a whole lot of opportunity as a young creative and then into a young leader that I probably wouldn't have got at a bigger business.
Right, okay.
And at times that was super scary because fuck, I can't do this. Mm-hmm. There were so many moments when I first became a CD there that I just felt like I wasn't going to be able to achieve what I needed to. And Porter's just gave me so much support and they really believed in me. Mm-hmm. And, it's just one of those special places that enable you to fall sometimes, but they'll catch you.
Yeah.
And in the long run, you sort of fly because of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't all perfect. I went through burnout a few times there, but you just learn so much from that. It's a pretty special place. I was pretty lucky to land there, I think.
Nice. I think as well, when you are in a small place that has given you that support, you naturally then want to give your all back, which is then why it probably feels quite so hectic. And you're like putting yourself in that position, but it's because you're so not like in debt to them, but you want to make it work because they really gave you that shot to do it, if that makes sense.
100%. You really believe in each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be super powerful. But it can also, at times, not toxic's not the right word, but it can become obsessive. Mm-hmm. For me, it did. At one point, I was so dedicated to that agency and to my job and trying to prove to them and myself that I could be what they always knew I could be. Mm-hmm. That, yeah, I did fall into burnout a few times. But, yeah, as I say, you know, the support was there and the belief was there. And I think sometimes when you're at your lowest, you actually learn so much and you bounce back from that so much stronger. So I wouldn't change anything about my experience at that agency. It was awesome.
Amazing. Is there like a particular piece of work or a particular campaign that you did there that you're like, that one, like that you look back on and absolutely loved working on?
Oh God, it was so varied. I mean, we worked on everything from luxury brands down to the supermarket. Do you know what? I think the most fulfilling for me would have been working on Sainsbury's, because when we won that account, I think I was still in a, we won it at Pitch, and I was still in a bit of a snobby, fashiony headspace of fucking hell, like I just want Prada. Like, what are we doing, you know, selling clothes next to the broccoli? Like, what the hell? But it was super fulfilling, because I think that was the first piece of work that really helped me understand how creativity can transform a brand or transform a business, mm-hmm. from a retailer into a brand, and being able to do that at a supermarket level and at, you know, such a scale, and being able to harness creativity to create a sort of a positive message for the world, mm-hmm. Which for Sainsbury's that was a platform called Dress Well, Feel Good, which was all about how clothing can impact your well-being.
Amazing.
That was so rewarding to be able to put that out and see that brand transform and shift a brand from, yeah, something that was literally just retailing, just flogging clothes, mm-hmm. into a business that stood for something. And that sort of got my heart and my soul, and I kind of went, I want more of that.
Amazing. Yeah, I think the luxury space, like the fashion world, I mean, I consume so much of it. I'm just like constantly looking at it. But I think it's, you're only really catering to a certain like market who are looking at that, and they're not really buying it because of a story or a narrative. It's like, well, I'm buying it because it's Prada and I like it. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So actually, kind of like having your hand forced to step away from that is super interesting, and being able to put into everything that you would do for those brands, but actually add that message, add that purpose, add that reason. And I think then probably being able to stand back and being like, oh my God, we did that. We made that into this, rather than another sort of like glossy campaign type of thing, must have been so interesting.
100%. I think, you know, the joy of working on a luxury brand is the resources that, mm-hmm. you have, particularly when it comes to talent and collaborations and partnerships and all that good stuff. But, you know, I think the high street, my God, it's a sea of same, right? Mm-hmm. It's all the same trends with all the same product and all the same prints, on all the same fabrications at all the same price. And, you know, the brands that win are the brands that, or the businesses that win on the high street are the ones that can create a brand out of themselves, mm-hmm. beyond the product story.
Yeah.
And that I think that experience and learning kind of how to do that on Sainsbury's, I'm able now to apply to all of the brands we work on. Create the story, find the point of view, mm-hmm. that is relevant in culture, that matters to your audience, because that's where you'll get that kind of level of distinction amongst a product landscape that, you know, fuck, I couldn't tell the difference between one store to the next on the high street at the, mm-hmm. moment.
Yeah, it's mad. I think they've like sort of half of them have gone down that, well, we should be more editorial route and we should look looks and we should bring people in this way. And then the other half is on that sort of purpose side of things. But what you're ingesting, like you said, it's all just the same. And you're like, I really can't tell one from another. Mm. And even with the products as well, at that certain sort of price point, they're all selling the same stuff for the same reasons, which is mad.
Yeah. I don't think it's one or the other. Mm-hmm. You know, for, you know, style credibility is a massive issue on the high street. And so some brands really do need to shift the dial there. And so a more editorial feel, body language of a brand is a good move. Mm-hmm. But then you go, okay, well, how can we take that and make it more inclusive? Mm-hmm. What casting choices can we make? What attitudes do we want those sort of models to portray, to feel just a bit more progressive and less bloody snobby? Mm-hmm. You know, let's not retouch out the cellulite.
Yeah.
I think you can still create goodness and put out positive messages. Not all brands need to be chatty and kind of really purpose driven to sort of add value to the world and to how we all feel about each other mm-hmm. and ourselves.
Yeah, for sure. And I think since then, a lot of your work has been more embedded, well, all of your work into culture and into helping brands portray and put out that more positive message and purpose-led stuff. Like, how do you sort of navigate briefs to make sure that those two things are paramount?
Yeah. That is driven by my own purpose. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when I was a little girl, God, even up until, honestly, three or four years ago, I would look in the mirror and just tear myself to shreds. I would hate how I looked. Mm-hmm. And I think that the fashion industry and the beauty industry and advertising in general and the media had a huge part to play in that. Just ridiculously unobtainable beauty standards and what good looked like as a woman. And so I felt like absolute crap, even though I loved fashion and was also a sense of joy and mm-hmm. creativity and self-expression. So, you know, little Zara, I don't want other girls to feel like little Zara felt. Mm-hmm. And also future Zara, you know, again, the advertising industry, the media brands are doing a bloody good job of making midlife seem a bit fucking depressing, right? So, like, let's sort of reshape that and change that too. So just going back to your question, there's an self-motivation to do that kind of work. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you only need to go and talk to Ali at Creative Equals or have a look at all the research out there. But that kind of work drives business growth. It reaches audiences at scale and it grows business. So I know that's the kind of work that I want to do and that brands need today. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so it's a pretty easy sell into clients. How do I navigate briefs? Well, it just starts with the right strategy. Mm-hmm. You know, when I joined Odd, I knew that we needed to put some stronger strategic foundations in place for the brands that we had mm-hmm. in order to create the right kind of work or the kind of work that I believed in. And that took, you know, that's not an overnight thing, right?
Yeah, of course.
That took me 12, 18 months, or us, the whole team, to land those foundations. Once you've got the foundations, the briefs will be right and the work will follow.
Mm-hmm. I think that's such an important point as well, because I think there's a sort of expectation of going into a new role and thinking, well, I'll be able to make great work because I'm here now and it's a different environment, it's different clients. But actually, it's when you strip it back a level and build it onto something that you truly believe in and what you truly believe is going to be the best for your brands, even if you're having to sort of labor for 12 months to actually then be able to get the briefs that you wanted. It is more about that building element of it, for sure.
Definitely. And it's worth it. You know, if it takes 12 months to get the foundations in place, to get the right creative briefs, to get even one piece of work out that you just feel in your soul that that was work that needed to be made,
mm-hmm.
then that is worth it.
Yeah. So how was the transition from Portis to Odd? Because obviously you'd been there for such a long time, it'd become such like a strong support network. How did that feel moving on?
I was ready to move on from Portis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it served me brilliantly. But by the end, I did feel a bit burnt out. I mean, God, who didn't during COVID? That was an absolute shit show for everyone, wasn't it? And I actually thought I wanted to leave the industry. I felt just done. And just before I did that, Nick, who was the founder of Odd, managed to convince me to come and join his gang. But, you know, smart guy, allowed me to take 3 months off to go and travel and just sort of chill and reconnect and regroup and just refocus on that, my purpose and what I was there to do. So I went in super fresh, and feeling clear on sort of the mission and how to create the kind of work that I wanted to create there. I don't think there was sort of, it just felt like a natural step. I don't really think there was a huge shift between the two.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, they were kind of similar businesses. I mean, very different business now, House 337, but
mm-hmm.
yeah, those two, quite similar, you know, very spirited, fashion expertise, founder led. So yeah, just sort of naturally just kind of slid in.
Yeah, nice. It's so important to have like been able to have that time off as well. I think it's still quite like an underestimated thing of going between jobs, and I always recommend, if people can, of course, just even if it's a week, like just take a week off and do something that isn't involving you having to think about everything consistently. And I think actually going into that refreshed, you will have had such a better experience from it as well.
Of course. And as you know, very few times in anyone's career except between jobs where you can take that moment mm-hmm. to pause. And for me, that was a really important moment because it allowed me to reflect on what I really enjoyed at Porter's and what I wanted to take through into Odd and the things that I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was during that time off traveling between the two that I sort of really honed in on the type of work that I thought the world needed to make and the type of work that I was passionate about. And had I not had that time off and that time to reflect, I think I probably would have gone running into Odd at a million miles an hour and just not had that clarity of this is the mission and this is what I'm going to do here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, nice. Because it is so easy to join somewhere and just get caught up in the sort of steam train of, well, everyone's making this stuff, I'm in, I've got to jump in it, and not like having that sort of reflection time of actually this is the type of work I want to make, this is the type of leader I want to be, and this is how I want to do that is so important. And like in being in leadership roles now, do you think that there has been like more key sort of factors throughout your career that have really sort of helped you be in those roles and do your job better?
I think having that support network around you
mm-hmm.
is really important. And it doesn't matter. That's not just a leadership thing. I think that's through your entire career, whether you're the intern or you're the CEO or you're the ECD or whatever the fuck, having your cheerleaders
mm-hmm.
and people who just have an unwavering belief that you can do it, whatever it is, for me has just been so important. Because, you know, it doesn't matter what you do and where you're at in your career. There are times that you feel, a lot of conviction and a lot of self-confidence, and you're away mm-hmm. and you're good. And there will always be times where, you know, imposter syndrome kicks in and you think you're shit and you don't know what you're doing and, oh my God, I'm going to die, mm-hmm. you know, and that network that you can look to, whether they're mentors or colleagues or, you know, your family, your partner at home, whatever, just having those people to be able to snap you out of it and lift you up and put you back on the path that you are on
mm-hmm.
Is, I think, one of the single most important things you could do for yourself.
Yeah, it's, you like need those people who almost sometimes know what you need more than you know what you need, and someone to say, just do this or you're going to be fine, crack on with it type of thing. Because yeah, I think especially being a woman, it's so easy, and I've definitely felt that imposter syndrome side of it of, well, I can't possibly do that, and you're not doing it because you're not trying, and there's like such a split between that. So yeah, I completely agree. I think it's so important to have those people around you, and I think it's important to find the people that are also like-minded around you as well, to be able to support and push you into doing the scary things.
Yeah, and you know, as long as you don't put yourself into like an echo chamber,
mm-hmm.
you need those people to call bullshit on you.
Yeah, so true.
If you are being a dick,
mm-hmm.
or you know, maybe getting it wrong or whatever, because that's the power of your network, is, you know, keeping you on your track and true to yourself, but not just being yes men.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Fuck, imposter syndrome though, like, oh my God, that is very, very real. And I think as you move from being a creative, you know, on the tools into leadership, you know, it does get sort of lonely at the top. That mm-hmm. feels cliche, but it's true. And you don't have as many people around you. You know, I don't have anyone that will go to me, you did really well in that meeting, Sarah, good stuff.
Yeah.
I don't fucking know if I did well or not. You've got to believe in yourself to yeah. get yourself through that. And you know, when imposter syndrome hits, just having the sort of deep-rooted self-belief to be able to snap yourself out of it,
mm-hmm.
or go to your network and allow them to snap you out of it.
Yeah.
You've got to do it, because otherwise you just eat yourself alive, particularly in, you know, when you're a leader.
Yeah, that is so true. And I don't know if I've ever thought about it in that way of like, I find myself, if I've done like a meeting or whatever or something, like you come out of it and you're kind of like, someone reassure yeah. me that was okay.
Yeah, and like, did I nail that or did I absolutely fuck it up?
Yeah, and it's like, I'm not gonna find out until we get the sort of results back from that. And then having to sit with that is terrifying. And I think, like, unknown, we're good at it in the sense of we have a leadership team and we're at the same level and we're all each other's cheerleaders. So you do have that element of it, but it's like a weird step, isn't it, from, you don't really notice it happens until you're then yeah. like, why is no one telling me that I did a good job? And it's such a weird dynamic, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. I think, like, for me, I just kind of, when that creeps in, that sort of that imposter syndrome moment, I just tell myself, shut the fuck up. I do not have time for that voice in my head right now. We can revisit you tonight.
Yeah.
If that's what we need to do. But right now in this moment, all you're doing is sabotage.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can, I've sort of just able to train myself to think in that way, and that's gotten me through so far.
It's so good though, you need it, and it's like, it is that element of just being able to back yourself in those positions. And it's like that, you kind of have to look back on the sense of, if I couldn't do this, I wouldn't be here.
Yeah,
like, and this is fine, and yeah, if I need to have a little wobble later when I'm at home and reflect on this, great, but just get on with it right now, because it's going to come out so much better.
Yeah, and I think it comes back to that sort of, what is my purpose, what is my why, mm-hmm. why am I doing this? And thinking about, you know, God, it sounds really naff, but thinking about little Zara and future Zara makes me remember what I am doing for me feels right. Mm-hmm. I know that this is the kind of work that I want to create. I really believe this is the kind of work that brands should be making. These are the positive messages they should be putting out. So when you do get those crippling sort of moments of lack of self-belief, just remembering that core kind of what am I here for, why do I believe in this, it just sort of brings things back on track.
Mm-hmm, for sure. Okay, so now your ECD at House 337, obviously following their merger with Odd, big old merger, I think the whole industry was like, what is going on, how is this happening, like how did you adapt through that merger, how did you find it?
Adapt. Yeah. So, you know, I was literally in Odd about 5 minutes before we merged. So, you know, I didn't really know any other world.
Right.
I think it would have been super difficult if, you know, for instance, you know, I was 10 years at Porter's, if then that ended up in a merger.
Yeah, of course.
Because you're so deep in the spirit of an agency and the culture of an agency when you're there for a while. I didn't have that with Odd. I came in at the time of the merger. So, you know, adaption less so. Lots of learning, particularly coming from small businesses and then being in, for me, what felt like a massive one.
Yeah, of course.
You know, wow, that was a big cultural change. And it required a different kind of leadership style, much more about, I don't know, you know, not really, I wouldn't say playing the politics of it, but things just happen slowly. Mm-hmm. When you're in a small business, you get three people around a table, you go, this is shit, or this is fucked up, what are we going to do to change it, crack on. Mm-hmm. And it's not like that at a big business. So yeah, learning how to really collaborate with leadership teams rather than just make the call and make the change myself was probably one of the biggest. But, you know, in terms of adapting the style of work or whatever, that just didn't – I know the kind of work that I wanted to make for Odd. It doesn't change for House. And so, you know, continue as is.
Mm-hmm. Nice. And is there, like, a particular thing that you hope to see the industry evolve into in the next 5 to 10 years? Is there, like, one particular trait that you hope to see more of in the industry? That was quite a big question. Sorry, I feel like I didn't.
Prep
you, but I went straight in.
Mate. Okay, look, I think that our industry need to be more collaborative. I think in housing is happening. It is real. You know, we have to, I wouldn't even say play nice with in-house teams. We have to be symbiotic with in-house teams and work together rather than trying to land grab. I think that needs to be a massive shift in how agencies are run, and, you know, truly see our clients as our partners. Particularly in that fashion space, because, yeah, as I say, in-housing is just, it will just go from strength to strength in the next few years. But also, you know, I think the type of work that the industry is making or will make in the future, I think will be much more varied. You know, we talked before about that sort of art copy peer feeling very traditional, and the type of work that's made out of that, you know, tally and print and out of home, it is very traditional, and it will still have a place in the mix of how a brand communicates. But I think, or what I hope to see in the industry, is way more diverse minds around a brief. You know, agencies might be made up of people from music world and food backgrounds and product backgrounds and tech backgrounds and writers and art directors, and, you know, maybe just the whole makeup of what is a team and who is creative. Maybe that will shift.
Nice. What is next for you? What are you excited about in the sort of next chapter?
Yeah. Look, I'm just kind of a big sponge at the moment. For me, I love leading. It just brings me so much joy. I love seeing a vision play out, and I love seeing teams grow.
Mm-hmm.
But I also really need to learn. And if I have one without the other, that's just an imbalance for me. So actually, next year, I'm going to sort of take a bit of a year off from leading and get learning and nice. Jump into a whole lot of different businesses, hopefully go freelance and just see how others do it and how other businesses are run. And, you know, I suppose the end goal for me is I'd love to get into a brand, mm-hmm. actually. I think, as I say, in-housing is happening. And, you know, I love brand transformation, and I think that's got to happen from the inside out.
Yeah.
And being part of a team within a brand that has control over that, rather than I think, you know, agencies can sometimes just get boxed off into the advertising bit.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really driven by tight budgets and what brands can afford and can't afford. So, you know, brand side, I think for me is just, yeah, having a bit more control or ability to, yeah, really grow something properly from the inside and having kind of a bit more say over how that brand expresses itself in all sorts of different ways, not just advertising.
Yeah.
Is exciting for me.
Yeah, super exciting. And I think it's something that is not really spoke about that much, in the sense of you being in-house, you do own that whole brand and that whole process. And it's less so about, well, we can sort of make you an ad that's going to do this and say this. It's actually how, as a brand on a whole, do we communicate across every level? And you kind of forget that, don't you? It's like, wait, we've got to do the e-commerce, we've got to do in-store, we've got to do all of the like advertising sense of it as well. And I think actually getting the opportunity to have a current or like a common theme and common narrative running through every single piece that someone touches is like a whole new world as well. And I think it's so much more, it's not so much more exciting, but it's so much bigger than I think a lot of people actually realize.
Yeah, and it's how people experience brands.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're in our own little world and advertising, going, oh, you know, the tally ad is everything. It's not. Ask someone on the street, what is your favorite brand and why?
Mm-hmm.
And it will, I more often than not, come down to the whole feeling that brand kind of brings them.
Mm-hmm.
And advertising is a huge part of it. It can definitely set a tone. It can definitely make you sit up and notice the brand. But yeah, that entire ecosystem is so important, because that is really how people in the real world are experiencing the brands that they love.
Yeah, I think it helps you get to know people as well. Whenever I'm chatting with creatives, I always say to them, what brands do you love? And they instantly are like, oh my God, I need to talk about them in advertising sense. I'm like, no, like not ads, like what brands do you just like? Who do you interact with? What do you like consume and watch and buy? And everyone is like, oh my God, I don't even know. Like, I need to think about it, because I think being in advertising, you're such like an audience of advertising rather yep. than actually who am I and what do I like? And it gives you such a better feeling of that person when you understand what they consume outside of work as well, which is always so interesting. And it also means I get to learn about so many cool brands that I had no idea about.
Yeah, I'm it's like, your oh. research.
Yeah, you know, and you're like, oh, cool, I totally know those guys. And then you're like on Instagram afterwards thinking, I have no idea who they are, and I feel very uncool because I don't. But it is such an interesting question, because like I think brands should be asking that, because actually your audience, like, who are they consuming with? Who are they consuming, and why aren't we doing that type of thing? So it's super interesting. And I think just going back to what you were saying about that sense of sort of leading and learning, I think it's so good that you have a self-awareness to be able to say, wait a minute, like I need to balance this out and I need to take some time for myself so that then when I do step back into leadership, I can be better at it as well. And like taking that jump into learning again is super exciting and interesting.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, like just letting go of the not even ego, I don't, you know, letting go of what other people will think if I step away from being a leader for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
Once I was able to get over that sort of, oh God, how's that going to look on paper thing, then I just really felt like this was the right thing to do. You know, we don't, at House, it's quite unique. We don't have a chief creative officer, right? Mm-hmm. We have a group of ECDs, the six of us, who sort of set and lead the creative vision. And I think that's really interesting. And it works in so many ways. It's, you know, a bit difficult in other ways. But for me, you know, I'm pretty new to the ECD thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I need to learn. We all need to learn. And so I just felt like this was the right time to just stop for a minute. Mm-hmm. And just you know, it was like, it's like that travel moment, right?
Yeah, of course.
When you take time out, you give yourself the opportunity to just take stock and work out, okay, what do I need to then be better in a few years' time?
Mm-hmm. And it will give you time to actually digest what you've learned being in an ECD sort of collective and people running it together, and you're always going to be bouncing off each other and learning consistently. But it's like, actually, let me have a moment to learn and reflect, and then work out in my next role, and maybe I'm not surrounded by five other ECDs, how I want to lead that and how I want to be, which is super interesting.
Yeah. Knowledge is power, right?
100%. And how do you think that the industry is gonna be able to sort of keep up and remain relevant for new like generations of creatives coming up?
Mm. I think that agencies need to really reflect on their values in the work that they make and the culture they create.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very clear set of values coming through from Gen Z, from Gen Alpha, Zalpha, whatever the fuck we want to call them.
I get so confused.
From the youth.
It would just bunch you all together.
No, but, you know, good for them. Like, they bloody know what they want and they know what they need and the world needs.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, agencies need to listen.
Mm-hmm.
And if agencies or businesses are adapting to that, then, you know, I think they'll be set up for attracting the right kind of talent.
Nice. And for the sort of, I was gonna just say the youth coming up, right, for the future generations coming up into the industry, do you have one piece of advice that you would give them?
Love that question. Find your purpose, find your fire, find the thing that you beyond what you do, why are you doing it? What's, you know, I see before, mine's the little Zara, future Zara thing. Find something really authentic within you. And that might actually take a while. You know, you're not just going to sit down with a pad and, mm-hmm. and a pen and go, okay, great, nailed it. But, and it might evolve and change, but just find the thing inside you that makes you really excited or driven to create. Yeah, this craft and the skill can come later, you can be taught that, but mm-hmm. the fire, the purpose, I think if you have that, you will find a path that's just brilliant for you.
Yeah, nice. And it's like about sort of allowing that to evolve and change as well as you get more experience with it, but it's always going to be that one sort of driving factor.
Yeah. Get more experience, but also go through life, you know.
Yeah.
Something that might really inspire you at the age of, I don't know, 20 might be quite different to something that you want to change or influence when you're 55.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that's important to sort of allow that to evolve. But to maybe it's, you know, that kind of idea of just taking a pause every now and again and taking stock. But if you have that purpose within you, then I think you will find your gang, you will find your people, you will find the right clients, you'll do the work that makes you really happy.
Yeah, nice. Sweet. And then we, this is my favorite bit, because we always ask our guests to bring a stinky fish with them. It's basically just something that you hate, that really winds you up, like a pet peeve, so to speak. And I'm actually really interested to know what yours is going to be.
What do you think it might be?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know.
Okay, Molly, I really can't stand moaning.
Okay.
I can't bear it. Look at what is happening in the world right now.
Yeah.
Look at Gaza. You know, look at what's going on in the Ukraine. Disease, poverty, the world is on fire, the fucking Amazon is, it's not good, the oceans are being fucked.
Mm-hmm.
And if someone comes to me and they just want a moan about, I don't know, the client wants the logo 5% bigger, honestly, can we get some perspective on that, please? Mm-hmm. I think it's really, really important for teams to be able to feel frustration and anxiety, because creative is quite personal, right?
Yeah.
And I think it's really important to create a space for people to be able to express that. But just having a moan with no sort of progress attached to it or no pathway forward is, I don't have time for it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm a pretty optimistic, positive person. And yeah, that just brings me down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're so right in that there's such a difference between a sort like a progressive moan of, oh, they want the logo 5% smaller, bigger, but it's fine because we're going to do X, Y, Z. Like,
yeah,
there's a difference between that than someone just moaning.
Just wanging on in their own sort of like puddle of shit. and not even looking for a solution. I think that's it. I think you're spot on. That's the difference is, you know, if someone comes to me with, this is the problem, I feel really crap or frustrated about it. How can we get out of it?
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, the clients ask for this, I don't believe that's the solution. How can we come up with a counter argument to move forward? Great. Yeah. I have all the time in the world for those conversations. But if it's woe is me, I hate this situation, I can't be fucked anymore, you know, like, no, let's just snap out of that immediately and move forward.
Yeah, 100%. I think Ollie, who founded Unknown, has like instilled this into all of us. And it's such an important trait that I do thank him for now. He's like, just if you're coming to me with the solution based thing as well, great, all is. If you're just moaning, I just don't care, I don't have time for it. And yep. I think you kind of need someone to say that to you, and need someone to like instill that self-awareness into you of being like, oh my god, I'm just being unbearable and moaning.
Yeah.
As well. So yeah, I like that one. That's a good one to chat about. And I think a lot of people listening to this will be like, shit, I should probably
fucking moan.
Yeah,
do you know what, actually I really genuinely believe that everybody is doing their best.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's on us as leaders to create an environment where people can thrive and do their best and create great work and be satisfied and feel fulfilled and all that kind of good stuff. So, you know, maybe if someone's just having a moan, maybe, you know, as a leader, you also have to look at yourself a little bit and go, what environment have I created?
Yeah.
That's stopped someone from caring anymore or wanting to find the way forward. So, you know, it's a sort of a shared situation, but as a leader, I think you've just got to pull people out of it. I do not have time for moaning. I can't bear it. And move forward.
Mm-hmm. Amen.
Amen.
Well, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. Absolutely love chatting with you. And yeah, I'm excited for your next year and sort of following you along with that and seeing what happens during.
Thank you. Me too. Let's see. Could be amazing. Could be an absolute flop. But
no, it will
be
amazing.
It's sort of the fun of it though, isn't it? You know, you've got to back yourself. So.
Exactly. No, it will be amazing, I'm sure.
Nice to chat.
Yes.
Okay. Thanks, Molly.